History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. All right, everyone, welcome back to our series on key battles of World War I. We are still setting the stage because there is a lot of stage to set. First of all, what we're going to do is take a closer look at these great powers that we described in the previous episode. We described them one by one, but they can't really be understood on their own. They have to be understood in terms of symbiosis. Just like you can't understand a crocodile and a hummingbird separately, or whatever bird it is that picks the food out of its teeth. You have to understand them together. I think that's a good analogy for World War I, right, James?
It's great.
Okay. What we talked about before was one of the most significant events in the 19th century in Europe was the unification of Germany. Deutschland über all else. That is the anthem. It doesn't really mean that Deutschland is better than all other nations, but you know, you can have that meaning if you want. It's more so that the idea of Deutschland, of Germany, supersedes all of the tiny independent states within it, of Bavaria, Prussia, Saxony. All these other different states are subordinate to the grand idea of Germany. One other thing I want to mention before we get into the details of German unification and the formation of these different alliances. When we talk about what's happening and all of these alliances with these different nations, and it makes people slip into World War I, there's something that's a little bit befuddling about this. Sometimes people wonder, wait, why did they have to get involved in this devastating war? It sounds like they had these alliances and they were sucked into it, but at any time they could have stopped and said, wait, let's just stop. I know I have this alliance, but it's not worth going into a horrible war that's going to cost tens and tens of millions of lives. It's almost like they're being pulled into a doomsday machine like Dr. Strangelove, where you drop a bomb on this device and then the apocalypse is automated and it's just running on its own and going out of control. One thing to keep in mind is that for the most part, everyone thinks that they're going to get something out of this war as it's gearing up. Nobody thinks it's going to be bad as it is, but they think that they're going to get a colony, they're going to get land back, kind of like what James was saying in the previous episode. France was still smarting about the loss of Alsace-Lorraine, and they wanted it back. Russia wanted a warm water port in Constantinople so they could build a big navy and access the Mediterranean. Germany wants control over the Middle East. So everyone thinks they're going to get something out of this. So I just hope that makes sense, as it seems like we're descending into madness with all these treaties, and why isn't anyone standing up and yelling stop and pulling the emergency brake on the train? So that's my setup there. James, please take us away.
All right. So once again, as we've already touched upon, but it bears repeating, German unification in 1870 had changed the balance of power in Europe. We could not emphasize that enough. Everything changed after that. But the German Chancellor Otto von Bismarck worked very hard to maintain peace and order in Europe and to make Germany indispensable to Europe. And he did this by forming an alliance. In 1873, only 2 years after the unification, Bismarck created the Drei Kaiserbund, or Three Emperors League. And this is Germany, Russia, and Austria. Three monarchies, monarchical empires, I should say, very conservative. But this eventually broke down when Russians' relations with Germany soured. After Bismarck was fired by Kaiser Wilhelm II, Russia was, you know, it just kind of struck out on its own. It broke away.
One other little thing I want to mention, we talked about how Kaiser Wilhelm was the grandchild of Queen Victoria, as was George V. But Nicholas II of Russia was the cousin of Wilhelm. And Wilhelm was half English himself, but he seemed to dislike the British, the land of his mother. There's a story that he blamed the English doctors who were at his birth for his withered left hand or his withered arm. So he tried to hide it by gripping the pommel of a sword with his left hand whenever he's in any state photo. So everyone, it seems to be related at the top power here. Everyone is slightly inbred. Just wanted to mention that fun fact. So please continue onward, James.
Yes. So once you have three Emperor's League and one departs, that means you have two now. So the dual alliance was the result after Russia broke away, and that was signed in 1879 between Germany and Austria. And then Italy joined the alliance in 1882, making it the Triple Alliance, also later going to be called the Central Powers because they're in the center of Europe. And going back to the diplomacy game that I talked about last episode, it is not fun to play any of those in diplomacy because you're surrounded. You've got people on your east and your west that are trying to crush you to death. And those three countries almost never win. Now, does that mean they're not going to win the war? Well, you'll just have to wait and see. We're going to leave you in suspense.
That's what we do.
That's what we do. Otherwise, why bother listening to the rest of the series? All right. Bismarck kept up relations with Russia. But as I said, the tie ended, even though the two rulers were cousins and they wrote each other letters in English, by the way. They were both fluent in English. Wilhelm didn't speak Russian and Nicholas didn't speak German, so they corresponded in English. I think that's kind of neat. So that's the Triple Alliance: Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Italy. Now, opposing them were the Triple Entente, and the roots of this began in 1894. Russia was needing a friend. Russia was not, you're not my friend anymore, not with Germany and Austria. So Russia made a very kind of an odd alliance with France. If you think about that, France is a republic. They were the most liberal, not liberal in the sense of 2020 liberal, but liberal in terms of not being a kingdom, being more democratic. They were the most liberal regime in all of Europe. And then that's France. And France is pairing up with Russia, who was the least liberal, the most conservative, the most autocratic, the most old-fashioned, old-school empire. But they had a common enemy, a common nation that they were suspicious of, and that was Germany. So the old saying is, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So on that basis, Russia and France formed a military alliance, the Entente Cordiale, or the friendly relationship. And this surprised other European powers because these two forms of government were so different. Britain, meanwhile, was beginning to feel a bit isolated. In some ways, they liked that, but in other ways, they didn't. And what's going to tip them over into not being isolated was in 1897. Kaiser Wilhelm II announced a new aggressive foreign policy called Weltpolitik, or, world policy. We're going to focus more on the world. And as I touched upon, I think in the last episode, he began constructing a large, powerful fleet. This alarmed Britain. Britain didn't want somebody challenging their supremacy on the seas. So they finally decided in 1904 to enter into the agreement with France, the Entente Cordiale. And this was not a formal alliance. I should clarify something I said earlier. The relationship between Russia and France was not the Entente Cordiale, despite what I said. I misspoke. It was a formal alliance. It was a formal military alliance. If somebody attacks one, the other will come in to go to war against the attacker. Britain's relationship was a little different. That was the Entente Cordiale, the friendly relationship, and it was not a formal alliance. Nevertheless, as we're going to see, for all intents and purposes, it's almost the same thing. And now with France, who is on the west side of Europe, and Russia, who is on the east side of Europe, being in allied together, this made Germany feel like they're encircled. And it's not just a feeling. They were encircled. Going back to my diplomacy game, Russia is on the far side of the map. There is nobody on the other side to attack them from the east. And there's nobody that's going to attack France from the west. They have their back up against the wall, so to speak. They don't have to worry about two front wars, but Germany does. Germany tried to provoke a colonial crisis in Morocco, of all places, Morocco. Yeah. Hey, let's stir up trouble in Morocco. Maybe this will divide England and France. Maybe we'll make them go to blows or something, go to war, at least have the relationship break down. It didn't work. In fact, the exact opposite happened. The two came even closer together in opposition to Germany.
They stink at false flag operations. I mean,
yeah, just not. Wilhelm II wasn't that great of a diplomat. He was, in fact, he was terrible.
We'll see what they try to do in Mexico and how that affects the U.S. and their decision to stay or go. But this is one part where Germany just does not do a great job of playing games to divide other enemies, false flag, entrapment, whatever you call it.
Yeah, Wilhelmian diplomacy is it's not very efficient. It's like the Keystone Cops or something. If y'all don't know what that is, Google it. But in 1907, Britain entered into an entente with Russia as well. And so now you have Britain, France, and Russia all together. And the relationship became known as the Triple Entente. And this is kind of surprising. Why is that?
Well, yeah, I mean, like you said, I think all three of these must be a little bit confused around the same side.
We're allied with who?
It's like, wait, we have to fight and die for them? What? To show the contrast, France and Russia, they're very different. On one hand, you have France, the anti-clerical government sentiment there. With Russia, the protector of Eastern Orthodox, very traditional in that sense. Britain and France, which had been centuries long enemies with one another, 100 years war, 30 years war, Napoleonic wars, not in recent decades.
They'd been enemies since at least 1066, right?
And then they sort of split apart in this Hydra head. Britain and Russia, I mean, they were competing throughout the globe to extend into the Eurasian continent. Those two are constantly clashing with each other. A very short anecdote, I looked at the life of this explorer, James Holman, who tried to cross Russia by sleigh in the 1820s, and he made it two-thirds of the way across the continent, but then the Tsar's officers caught him in the city of Irkutsk and deported him because they thought he was a British spy. So this type of suspicion between the two empires goes back very far. It's weird. I mean, they just had been looking upon each other in confusion. So, okay, we're going to fight, and okay, I guess we'll go for it.
Yeah, and don't forget that France and Britain had been at war with Russia just 60 years earlier in the Crimean War. You know, things are changing. Things are changing, and you've got new – this is your new friend, by the way. So it's kind of like if you had three kids on a playground who beat each other up and then later decide, you know, let's just bury the hatchet and let's be friends.
Yeah, we have a bigger enemy to take down, so we'll put our differences aside, and there they go.
They kind of had to. They were forced to, because you didn't have this big, powerful Germany prior to 1870. But now, you know, desperate times call for desperate measures, right?
Yeah, there they are.
All right, so these alliances were intended for peace and stability in Europe, but as we're going to see, it's going to have the exact opposite effect. And I want to give a quote from Barbara Tuchman, the great scholar of the 20th century who wrote the classic work, The Guns of August. Tuchman wrote that Europe, because of these alliances, Europe was, quote, a heap of swords piled as delicately as jackstraws. One could not be pulled out without moving the others. All right. So now we're going to move on to the Balkans. And Scott's going to set up a little bit of a background to the Balkans. You know, in Texas, we have a joke. We say, if you don't like the weather, wait 10 minutes and it'll change. Well, the Balkans in the 1800s, early 1900s, you could say, if you don't like the current boundaries, just wait a couple years and they'll change. So tell us about that.
There are so many revolutions going on there. The Ottoman Empire controlled it, but its power is receding. You have the Serbian Revolution in 1813, and then they gained full autonomy in 1878. Greece gets autonomy in the 1820s. Bosnians have a revolution in the 1830s. There's the Bulgarian Revolution in 1878. That has to do with Russia stepping in. The Congress of Berlin was a diplomatic treaty in 1878 after a war between Russia and Turkey that leads to a largely independent Balkans, and then it's completely independent in 1912. So the Ottomans had just fought a ruinous war a couple of years earlier and horrific violence. So it's sort of a warm up for what's going to happen in World War One, but already a lot of action going on in the Balkans. So what's happening there, James?
Yeah, this is the main thing I studied in grad school, the Balkans. And man, it is confusing. You'll leave your head spinning. But suffice it to say that the receding of the Ottoman Empire led to a power vacuum in the Balkans. And Bismarck, again, we'll talk about Bismarck some more. Bismarck had a great quote. He had done all this work, you know, to establish alliances and to promote peace and maintain the balance of power. And he said, you know, all this work is going to be undone by, quote, some damn fool thing in the Balkans, unquote. So we're going to see that he had the gift of prophecy, perhaps. But no, he just he was very insightful and understood how the world was and what was going to happen. Austria saw the Balkan nations as a threat. We talked about this in the last episode. Russia coveted a relationship with the Balkan nations. Austria in particular was worried about Serbia, who we've already said, but it bears repeating, it's super important for understanding the outbreak of the war. The Serbs wanted a pan-Slavic state. The nation of Serbia did not have all the ethnic Serbs in it, and they wanted to have all those Serbs, and most of those Serbs wanted to be part of Serbia. They didn't want to be part of Hungary or part of whatever nation. So that's a major problem.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
In 1908, Austria annexed Bosnia-Herzegovina, or just Bosnia for short. Austria had administered Bosnia since 1878. It's just one of those crazy things that Scott and I have studied quite a bit. And, you know, there'd be a part of the world that was, oh, it's technically part of the Ottoman Empire, but it's actually being administered by another country. And the Austrians had, it's like
the Anaheim Angels of Los Angeles. Is that right? Did I get that right?
I don't know what they're called. It changed. That's another thing. If you don't like it, just wait a couple of years. But, or the Rams, right? Or I don't know. But anyway, Bosnia had been directly ruled by the Ottomans from the Middle Ages, you know, from the 1300s all the way to 1878. And at that point, Austria took over administration of them. You know, you're still part of the Ottoman Empire, but we're going to manage the place. And then they finally said, this is ridiculous. Let's just take it over. Let's just make it official. So Austria annexed Bosnia in 1908. And of course, this infuriated Serbia because they thought that was something that they were entitled to. Moving ahead, 1912, the Balkan League, which consisted of the small nations of Serbia, Montenegro, Bulgaria, and Greece, attacked and defeated the Ottoman Empire, taking most of the remaining Ottoman territory in Europe. And this is called the First Balkan War. And of course, everybody knows that if you call something the first something or other, that means we're not done. There's going to be another one. And sure enough, one of the allies, one of the members of the Balkan League, Bulgaria, was not happy with the land they got. They didn't get enough, you know. My piece of the pie is too small, so I want more. And they attacked their former allies. Bulgaria actually attacked the rest of the Balkan League, and this is called the Second Balkan War. The allies, that is Serbia, Montenegro, and Greece, also Romania jumped in just for grins. I think the Ottomans, the Ottomans also fought against Bulgaria. They beat Bulgaria. Bulgaria lost. And Serbia gained new confidence. It also gained new territory, and its population increased from 2.8 million to 4.4 million. So that's a big increase. So, yeah, as we've already touched upon, a lot of instability, a lot of fighting. Borders are constantly changing. And if you don't like the country you're in, just wait a few years and you'll probably be in a different one. This leads us up to 1914, the summer of 1914. Scott, did you want to say anything else?
Well, just another factor, too, of how little things that are happening at this time have centuries-long aftershocks. In the nation of Turkey, most of it is on the Asian continent and Anatolia. But there's a tiny little rump of it that is on the European continent. You start in Istanbul and you drive about 2 or 3 hours west and you hit the Bulgarian border and there you are. Why is the border there? Because that's where the army stopped in the Balkan Wars and no other reason. So little accidents of history that are happening, the things that we're talking about here, are going to have long-term ripple effects that are still affecting things today. So World War I matters, people. If we don't sell you on any other idea, hopefully it's that one.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Dan Carlin in his podcast argues that the most historically significant person of the 20th century is Gavrilo Princip. Now, everybody raise your hand if you know who that is.
I see one or two hands, but not a lot.
A handful of hands went up. These are history fanatics listening to this, so some of them are going to know. We'll talk about him in a minute. But let's set the stage for what happens, what's called the July Crisis in 1914. So, as we said earlier, the ruler of Austria-Hungary was Emperor Franz Joseph, and he was a very old man. He was in his 80s. He had already gone through several successors who had died on him. In 1914, his successor was his nephew, a man named Archduke Franz Ferdinand. He's the man in waiting. He's the heir apparent. He's the person who's going to take over the whole empire once Franz Joseph gives up the ghost, finally. Franz Ferdinand, and there's a lot of interesting stuff to talk about with him, but let's skip over it for the sake of time. And let's suffice it to say that they decided to go visit the city of Sarajevo. Sarajevo is the capital of Bosnia, which is, of course, one province or one part of the Austrian Empire at this time. Now it's the capital of the nation of Bosnia, but back then, again, just a provincial capital, part of the empire. And the Austrian army was doing military exercises there, so he wanted to go visit those and, you know, rally the people, work the crowd, make some speeches, rally everybody, you know, get everybody pumped up for Austria. He picked a really bad day. June 28th is the anniversary of the Battle of Kosovo, or full name is Kosovo Polje, which is the Field of Blackbirds. And this was a battle that took place in 1389, in which Serbian resistance to the Ottoman Empire was crushed. The Ottoman army marched in and crushed the Serbian army. It wasn't the total end of Serbia. Serbia is going to limp along as its own sick man for a while, but it was the beginning of the end. It was, and it's practically a holy day for Serbs.
Oh yeah.
I can't tell you how many times I was sitting in coffee shops in Banja Luka and other places among Serbs, and the conversation almost inevitably goes back to Kosovo Polje. You know, it's kind of like in the South, certain parts of the South, the conversation's going to go to the Civil War. He picked an absolutely horrible day. I don't know if he just didn't know about it, or, you know, it's just really, really bad choice of days to go. The Serbs are going to be celebrating that national time of national mourning for the Serbs. I could go into a lot more detail, but I will not. Anyway, the Serbs are riled up, and not only are they riled up, but there was actually a secret organization of Serb radicals, and it was called the Black Hand. I like that name.
Yeah, ominous.
Yes, it doesn't sound good. This is not like a charitable organization. You know, this is not a origami club or something. These guys are up to no good, and they were conspiring specifically to assassinate the Archduke while he was in Sarajevo. The thought was, we want to strike a blow to the Austrians. We want to free Bosnia from Austrian rule. And what would be a better way to do that than killing the heir apparent? Nothing but good will come out of that, right? It'll be great.
They'll just give you independence if you pull that off. Yeah.
Okay, fine. You guys can be independent. We'll give Bosnia to Serbia. Yeah, that's going to happen. But anyway, the Black Hand's motto was union or death. And their leader was a man named Dragutin Dimitrijević. He was a officer in the Serbian army. He had an alias of Apis, and he was running this organization. Now, I should say from the start that it was not officially run by the Serbian government. The Serbian government didn't call the shots. They were a private organization, but they did have members who worked in the government. But it's not a conspiracy run from Belgrade. All right, so the assassins, of whom there were at least six, different sources give different numbers, six or seven probably, they were stationed all over the city of Sarajevo, and they repeatedly failed in their mission. They either gave up or they chickened out, or they just couldn't get to the Archduke because of the crowds. Eventually, though, the car containing the Archduke and his wife took a wrong turn, and they had to back up. The driver backed up the car, and it just so happened that the exact location where he started backing up was right by a coffee shop in which was sitting one of the six or seven assassins. And this is a man named Gavrilo Princip. There he is. Oh. Princip saw the car backing up. He saw the Archduke and he thought, wow, here's my chance. He ran out there, pulled a pistol that he had. He shot the Archduke and his wife at close range, and he killed both. Now, there's irony in this because the Archduke was actually one of Serbia's best friends among the Austrians. The Archduke had been talking about giving more autonomy to Slavs within the empire. He even floated the idea of possibly turning the dual monarchy into a triple monarchy, where you would have centers of power in Austria, in Hungary, and then perhaps in Croatia or among the Slavs. The Slavs would be kind of be a third head of the empire. I don't know how well that would have worked, but suffice it to say that the Archduke was not somebody who hated the Slavs or the Serbs. He was probably their best friend within the Austrian government, and yet they killed him. Princip tried to commit suicide twice, actually, but he failed both times, and then he was arrested and thrown in jail. Now, Austria was convinced, or at least wanted to believe, that the Serbian government itself was behind the assassination, despite a lack of hard evidence. And so the Austrians decided to get even with Serbia. A lot of them had wanted to attack Serbia anyway and wipe them off the map. Now here's the chance. Here's the excuse. But Austria wasn't the greatest military power in the world, and they realized that if they attacked the Serbs, the Russian bear might wake up from its slumber and come and start slapping them around. So Austria needed Germany's help. They needed Germany's support. So the Emperor Franz Joseph asked the Kaiser Wilhelm II if Germany would support Austria. And the Kaiser and the German government said, yes, do what you need to do. And this is on July 5th. And this has come down to history as the blank check, meaning Germany would support Austria, whatever they did. So on July 23rd, remember, this is almost a month after the assassination, Austria-Hungary sent an ultimatum to Serbia with multiple demands. It had a couple dozen points, things they had to do. And it was just absolutely absurd. One of the points, we won't go into all the points, but one of the points was that the Serbs had to agree to let the Austrians come in and run the investigation of trying to root out the conspiracy, trying to determine how deeply involved the Austrian government was in the assassination plot and all that. It was a major affront to Serbia because Serbia was going to have to basically give up its sovereignty. And the Serbs said no. I mean, we'll do almost all these things. They accepted all the conditions except a few. Some of them they had questions about, but this was the only one they refused outright, the demand that Austria run the internal investigation into Serbian affairs. They said, no, we just cannot do that. That's giving up our sovereignty. Russia and Britain offered peace proposals, but Austria rejected them. So Austria, after 48 hours, declared Serbia's response to the ultimatum unacceptable. And on July 28th, they declared war on Serbia. The next day, they began bombarding Belgrade. At this time, Belgrade was in the far north of Serbia. Today it's not, but back then it was. And they started shelling the city. So now war has become. And the question is this just going to be like the Third Balkan War? Is it going to be a local thing like we've seen throughout the 19th century? Or is it going to blow up? Well, I think you already know the answer to that based on the fact that this is called the First World War. But at the time, nobody knew for sure what was going to happen.
Well, thanks for that setup. That's fantastic. And everything you said so far, I think, makes perfect sense. People can understand exactly what's going on, what the conflict is between Austria-Hungary and Serbia. Now, the next step, I think, is where it gets confusing for a lot of people. And this, just to telescope out for a second, is what confuses people for World War I when World War II seems to have much more clarity. World War II can be dumbed down like almost no other complex war. Hitler bad, Allies good. Hitler's evil. You have no better villain than Hitler. Let's stop Hitler. Let's stop fascism. Let's go over there and fight that. Hitler and Germany expand because of Aryanism and Nazism and all these things. So we have to stop that. Okay, makes sense. Great. But this step from when Franz Ferdinand is assassinated to this incredible unraveling that takes place, that what you or I would assume would simply be a Third Balkan War and a local flare-up in Serbia and, you know, a few thousand soldiers, a few tens of thousands die, and then a border and a few cities are shifted back and forth and it's over. No, a world war happens, and a few years later, America is even drawn into it. And there's a great book about America's involvement in World War I called The Yanks Are Coming by Harry Crocker. And his argument is that it was worthwhile for America to be involved because he's pushing back against the thesis that many people think America simply should not have been involved. This was due to this Rube Goldberg machine of alliances in Europe that even the alliance writers themselves could barely understand. America didn't gain much. All it did was make Germany mad, the result of World War I, and it led directly to World War II. So it was just a waste of our blood and treasure to even be involved. And that's what some people think about this. So what is going on, James? What goes from an assassination of an important person, but still a next in line in the throne, not even a leader of a great power, an assassination of him, into kicking up this massive machine that leads to doomsday? Was it just basically on autopilot that led from this assassination to a war, or what happened?
Yeah, it's funny that you use the term doomsday machine, because that's the exact term that Dan Carlin uses in his world.
Yeah, that was probably in the back of my mind.
I think it's very fitting. You had the alliance system, as I quoted from Barbara Tuchman earlier. You can't just pull out one. The whole thing collapsed. All these great powers had promised that if so-and-so attacks this guy, I come in and help. Okay, if A attacks B, I will attack A to support B, and so on. You know, it started with, there's a great cartoon that I show in my classes where you have Serbia as a little bitty kid, and there's a slightly larger person coming up and starting to punch on him, and it's Austria, and then a little bit bigger or a lot bigger person comes up, that's Russia, and starts beating on Austria. Russia had promised to come in on the side to help Serbia out if they were attacked, so they now are obligated to attack Austria. And that makes the Germans uncomfortable because the Russians start mobilizing. Every country had these mobilization plans, which basically means calling the army up, getting the reserves out, getting them active, getting them in uniform, getting them formed into formations and getting them armed and things like that. The Russians mobilize. That makes the Germans nervous. So the Germans are going to have to mobilize. Well, that makes the French nervous. So it's like a series of dominoes falling over. And then you had the plans, and we'll talk more about this, in particular the German war plan, which is going to have a huge impact on the war. But the military people gradually seem to take more and more control, and the civilian leaders tend to allow that. They tend to let the military take over, particularly in Germany. Let me give you a quote from this is a book called A World Undone, The Story of the Great War, 1914 to 1918 by G.J. Meyer. Terrific book. My favorite one-volume World War I book that's out there. The Kaiser actually started having second thoughts about attacking France. And we'll get into why he's going to have to – he feels he has to do that later. France hasn't even – it's not even in this party yet. But the Germans had this plan that if Russia attacks us, we've got to hit France first and knock them out. We can knock them out real fast and then turn around and devote all of our might to Russia. Well, the Kaiser was hoping that France might stay neutral. He kind of thought they might. And so he said to his chief of staff, basically the commanding general of the army, a man named Helmut von Moltke, he said, can we just leave France alone? And can we turn and send the whole army east toward Russia? And Moltke wrote later, I assured His Majesty that this wasn't possible. The deployment of an army of 1 million men was not a matter of improvisation. It was the product of a whole year's work, of timetables that once worked out could not be changed. If His Majesty insisted upon leading the whole army eastward, he could not have an army ready to strike. He would have a confused mass of disorderly armed men without commissariat. Sorry. Okay, that's the end of the quote. So basically, it's kind of like, well, we've already got these plans. We've got to do them. We've got to carry them out. We can't just change the plan at the last minute.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
All right. So did that answer the question fairly well?
Right. I mean, I suppose in some way there's no satisfactory answer. We hear this and we seem a bit befuddled, but I mean, these empires were geared for war with one another, and yeah, this is the outbreak that caused it.
This is the plan. We got to stick to the plan. So, as I touched upon a little while ago, to support Serbia, Russia ordered the mobilization of their armed forces, and this is on July 30th. The German chief of staff, Helmut von Moltke, here's another good quote from him. He wrote that if a war came, quote, the leading nations of Europe would tear one another limb from limb in a struggle that would destroy the culture of almost all of Europe for decades to come. It's pretty,
pretty close. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's in a day when a lot of leaders felt like, oh, we can just knock this out. We'll be done by Christmas. Nope. Moltke was right. The next day after Russia mobilized, Germany sent an ultimatum to Russia, basically saying, stop mobilizing or face war. Russia did not stop. They continued mobilizing. On August 1st, Germany declared war on Russia. The next day, Germany declared an ultimatum on Belgium, on the other side, to the west. The Germans had a plan called the Schlieffen Plan, which we'll go into more detail on in our next episode. But for now, suffice it to say that, once again, the German plan or the German thinking was that if we're going to really be able to fight Russia to the death, we've got to first neutralize France. We've got to knock out France just like we did in 1870. It worked then. It'll work now, right? Well, maybe, maybe not. But that was the plan. And so Germany realized we're going to have to book it. We're going to have to really hustle and get into France. The normal way you would invade would be through Alsace and Lorraine. Sorry for the pronunciation error, but I know we'll have many more of those. But
deal with it, people. We're doing our best, but you know,
we are. Neither one of us knows French. I don't. Do you know French? I don't know it, but
I sort of knew how to read it.
There you go. Yeah,
French is, the pronunciation is exactly the same as what's on the page, right?
Yeah. All right. Anyway, so we'll do our best. But anyway, back to Belgium. Germany realized we can't go through Alsace-Lorraine. It's too well fortified. The French have a lot of troops there, so we'll go through Belgium. There's one problem with that, though. Belgium was neutral. And in fact, Germany had signed a treaty back in the 1800s saying that we will respect Belgian neutrality. Well, they're going to tear that up and say, forget it. So Germany sent a message to Belgium saying, basically, when we're going to come through and you just stand aside, don't bother us. We won't bother you. You just kind of stand there and we'll high five you as we go through. Oh, that wasn't there. But anyway, the idea is don't mess with us and nothing bad will happen to you. We're just passing through. We don't have no problem with you. We're going to attack France. And Belgium said, sure, no problem. That's fine. In fact, we'll hand you little bottles of water like it's a marathon or something. I'm kidding. They didn't do that. Belgium said, no, you can't just march through our country. We're a sovereign nation. We're not some highway that you can just take. So Belgium refused. And then Britain, finally, realizing that Belgium is about to be neutralized, they come off the fence. No more of this splendid isolationism. Britain tells Germany that if they violate Belgium's neutrality, then Britain would go to war with Germany. And Germany said, we don't care. In fact, there's a funny quote. Somebody said to the Kaiser, what are you going to do if the British army comes? If the British army lands in France and gets in our way, what are you going to do? And the Kaiser said, I'll have them arrested. Because the British army was very small, and that's the amount of respect he had. Like, they're so small, I can just send the police in and just drag them off. We'll see how that works out. So, on August 3rd, Germany declared war on France. The next day, they invaded Belgium. They'd already gone into Luxembourg, a little tiny principality that couldn't really do anything about it. And, you know, the Germans couldn't believe this is, we're going to see this in World War II as well, but the Germans thought the English were kind of their, what would you say, kindred spirits, I suppose would be the word. We're the same people. We're just speak different languages, but why do the British want to get involved? Why do they want to help out this little pathetic nation of Belgium? In fact, they said, why do you, Bethmann Hollweg, the W is pronounced like a V, the chancellor said, why are you going to go to war over a scrap of paper? You know, they called the treaty a scrap of paper. Well, Britain didn't see it that way. And so the following day, Britain declared war on Germany. And on August 12th, they landed the British Expeditionary Force, the BEF, of 120,000 soldiers in northern France, to kind of hold the line should the Germans come that far. The Germans, by the way, did not arrest them. They did not arrest them. They're going to try in a manner of speaking, but we'll see what happens. At the same time, Italy backed out of its alliance. Italy says, yeah, I know technically we're aligned with Germany and Austria-Hungary, but nah, we're going to be neutral. They invoked a principle called sacred egoism, meaning we have the right to do what we feel like, regardless of whether we had a treaty or not. It's talk about your scrap of paper. This is scrap of paper too. But anyway, all right.
It's just more, it's not a treaty. It's just more of a guideline. It's more of a best practices, whatever.
Exactly. And we're not up to it. So with this, now all this having happened so quickly in just a few days, the two sides of the war were now set. You're going to have the Central Powers, Germany and Austria-Hungary, versus the Allied Powers, Britain, France, and Russia. Italy is going to be neutral for now. None of the other nations are going to get involved at first. But this is blown up and rapidly escalated to the point where it's not just a Balkan war. It's not just a little scrap between two nations. It's going to be a general European war fought on at least two fronts. We're going to see later it's going to expand to many more than that.
Well, yeah, thanks for that. Was great, James, setting that up. And I have a quote as well to round out this episode. But before I get there, I have a little bit of a thought experiment I want your input on. A while ago on the Facebook group for History Unplugged, I was asking people a hypothetical, and I forget what the hypothetical was. It might have been, who's the most significant person you think in history? Or if you had the opportunity to kill someone, who would it be? And that's always a fun thought experiment. And somebody mentioned for the killing thing, Gavrilo Princip, for that exact thing, that had this assassin not been successful in assassinating Franz Ferdinand, then World War I wouldn't have happened. There wouldn't have been this apocalyptic chaos. Tens of millions of people wouldn't have been needlessly killed, and the world would have been better. Other people talk about Franz Ferdinand as being one of the most significant people in history. But tell me what you think about this, if you agree or disagree. I don't think Franz Ferdinand was important. He's sort of like the first domino in a series of dominoes, or the first atom that triggers a nuclear explosion. I mean, yes, he's significant for what he triggers, but by himself, he just happened to be in a certain place, and like a Forrest Gump, he just happened to be at a very significant world historical moment, and all these things result. But based on what you described there, it seems like it's this doomsday machine that's turning on. I mean, it sounds like a plot of a dystopian sci-fi book where war is given over to computers or machines, and then machines fight machines, and then the war spirals out of control far beyond whatever the human creators intended. And it seems if not for Franz Ferdinand, then somebody else would have done something to trigger these alliances that are drawing people in when, okay, I understand Russia's mobilizing, Germany is threatening Russia, but then it's threatening France. It doesn't have anything to do with this, but it has to do it because it can't ignore France, and this is what the treaty dictates. So they're just making the first move, so Germany itself isn't attacked by France. So what do you think about this? Do you think that Franz Ferdinand, okay, yes, he's symbolic, but overall really not that important, and if not for him, something else would have caused World War I?
Yeah, I heard somewhere recently that I don't know if this was on your podcast or somewhere else, but if somebody had gone, let's say, back in 1910, and if, let's say, they're an Austrian or a German, not a Serb, and had assassinated Archduke Franz Ferdinand, like, say, in Austria somewhere, then there would have been no World War I. Or if, let's say, Gavrilo Princip broke his leg before he and didn't even go to Sarajevo. By the way, I should mention, I meant to say this. I've actually stood on the exact spot in Sarajevo where Princip stood when he shot the Archduke and his wife.
Wow. It's
very interesting. Yeah, he's kind of a hero among at least some of the Serb people, seen as a liberator of the Serb people. I'm not sure I totally agree with that, but they used to have the place where his feet supposedly stood, like indented to where you could stand in them, kind of like the footprints in that Chinese theater where the movie stars get their feet. But you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, yeah, the man.
They
Chinese
had them
theater.
Painted yellow. I don't think that's the case anymore, but I have stood on the spot, and I've also seen the exact car that the Archduke and his wife were in, and the Archduke's blood-stained tunic, or his coat, his uniform coat, in a museum in Vienna. So that's pretty cool that I actually got to see all that. I lived in Sarajevo for over a year. The downtown part hasn't changed much from back in the 1900s, the early 1900s. But anyway, let's say there had been, no Franz Ferdinand by 1914, or no Gavrilo Princip. Princip dies of pneumonia when he's 15 years old or something. So that means no World War One, and therefore no World War Two, and probably no Cold War, and the world would be a much better place, or at least a very different place. I'm like you. I'm skeptical about that. I think that something would have happened. I think about Bismarck, you know, some damn fool thing in the Balkans. If there had been no assassination in Sarajevo on June 28, 1914, I think there would have been something else. Remember what Tuchman said? A bunch of swords were piled up like matchsticks and you couldn't pull one out without the whole thing collapsing. I think with the alliance system and the tension between Germany and Russia and Germany and France and Austria and Russia, I think something else would have triggered some kind of war. Now, would it have been this apocalyptic, massive war in which 10 million people are going to be killed just in battle alone? I don't know. But I don't think we could say, oh, nothing would have happened. I think something would have definitely happened. It's kind of like a pile of rags that have been doused in gasoline. You know, maybe I don't go up and toss a match in it, but eventually a car is going to go by and throw out a spark, or something's going to happen and it's going to ignite. That's just my thought anyway.
Right. I think we both veer on the side of something would have happened. And obviously we don't know. History is a mixture of, there are social systems that can sometimes make it appear like there's inevitability in a moment. And then other times it seems that there's a person who appears that moves the tides of history, Alexander the Great, Napoleon, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, that, and we'll see him later. Can't wait to get into that episode. So it's both and, we don't know. I'm sure there's a wonderful historical alternate history book out there if this event would not have happened. But Europe is a powder keg. I think you illustrated that very well in your overview. And I'd like to close out this episode with another quote. This is from Sir Edward Grey, Britain's foreign secretary. He seems to see what is going to happen. Others might think it's going to be a short war. But when he received word that Germany declared war on France, he saw street lamps being lit below his office window in London. And he said to a friend, "The lamps are going out all over Europe. We shall not see them lit again in our lifetime." So that is our setup. James, we are getting into the first battle in the series. What is that battle?
We're actually going to go out to the east to start things off. We're going to look at an epic, just massive battle between the Russians and the Germans, which later became known as the Battle of Tannenberg.
All right. Well, we will sink our teeth into that one, and we will see you in the next episode. There you have it. That is all for today's episode. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spy Masters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our fantastic Spy Masters include Chris C., David Santee, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Jake Harrington, Jennifer French Lee, Josh Reddick, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial in Las Vegas, Michael from New York, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Ryan Gillen, Salvador Sanchez, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Bill Ivy, and Bruce Ashby from Wire Meets Wood Guitars at WMWGuitars.com. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the intelligence officer level, get all the stuff that scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the spymaster level, you'll get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on Earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.